Hello, everyone. This is the Stark Truth. I'm your host, Robert Stark. My guest today is Anthony Mikkels from the Netherlands. Hey, Anthony. It's nice having you back on the show.
And great being back, Robert. Thank you.
And your website is realcurrencies.wordpress.com. And I guess where we can get started is this article you have, Fighting Free Market Fundamentalism. And you have a picture up there with a quote by Paul Ryan, and he's talking about his one of his idol is Ayn Rand.
Yeah. I think that's, I like that picture because beneath that picture of I'll get the article myself because it's nice quoting this, but. Because what it basically says is that Anton LaVey apparently has admitted or has said that to him what he considers his religion, which is Satanism, as you know, is just a ritual added to Ayn Rand's philosophy. So obviously you are aware of my position regarding Austrian economics, and you know it's related to social Darwinism and it's ultra-capitalism and it's anarcho-capitalism that it promotes, which is ultra favorable to the rich, as I have analyzed extensively at realcurrencies.wordpress.com. And I think it's very difficult to argue with the founder of the Church of Satan saying something like that.
So you talk about the arguments that the libertarians make. So they make legitimate arguments that the current economic system. That big government played a role in helping the big corporations and a financial system set up. But the use argument is that the flaw of the libertarians is even though they have legitimate points, they dissolve the plutocrats of any guilt whatsoever, and they just put it all on the government.
Yeah, it's quite obvious. I mean, if you're going to blame the state for supporting the plutocrats and creating monopolies in the market, why do you blame the state instead of the people that are bribing the politicians to do so? I mean, it's a logical fallacy of the first order. And what is even worse is that in another article that I did this summer, The Few Banks That Own All, I was quoting a recent study by some Swiss mainstream analysts, and they concluded that all the major corporations were owned by only, well, a little more than a handful of banks worldwide. So there is a worldwide monopoly, a worldwide real monopoly there of all the major banks owning each other and owning all transnationals. And obviously there is no world government yet, so they managed to do this, notwithstanding national sovereignty.
And that's the thing is, I mean, a lot of people talk about a world government, and it's really hard to say whether that will happen or not, but the one world system that all these people are talking about, it's happening through the economic system, through the multinational corporations and the international finance, rather than the governments themselves all merging together.
Absolutely. And mind you, of course, international governance like the WTO, the UN, et cetera, is quite real. And it's obvious that they are that they want more with anti-global warming, global warming must be combated with major supranational institutions, and the World Trade Center, the World Trade Organization, obviously is dissolving national borders and national sovereignty to gain access for multinational corporations. But to say that the state is doing this and that they are making this possible for corporations is just turning everything upside down.
And that's the thing, the libertarians, a lot of libertarians, they go on and they say that, oh, they're libertarians will run against, like, the New World Order, but they don't really, they're still actually supporting the same thing that they oppose in that sense.
Well, you know, they are saying the state is doing all this, but they're just ignoring market power, and or they're not even ignoring it, because when I say they ignore it, they all the trolls on my site, they come and say, well, they don't ignore it, and read Murray Rothbard, this and that book. But the real fact is that the so-called free market will immediately be usurped by the main market players, which are the big banks, the big transnationals, and they are very much in favor of so-called free market capitalism because they will completely monopolize the market ASAP, as they have done always. And it does not matter what, they don't need the state to do this. All they need is the state not to stop them. That is the real issue. And that is not that I'm saying, oh, the state is the great solver of all these problems, because obviously it is not. The state has clearly failed to an incredible extent, and we have a major problem with state tyranny, always have had for ever since the Roman Empire and even long before. But it is quite clear that the dissolving of the state will absolutely do nothing to stop monopolistic power in the marketplace, and that's what it's all about.
So what you're saying is that the even though the state's corrupt, the free market types will look to the state being corrupt, and they think reducing the state will just fix all these problems. But you're saying that change will have to come by using some government policies rather than just reducing the government.
Well, I'm not really even too sure about that. My basic point is that dissolving the state will not solve the problem. That's what I'm saying. Whether the state should be solving the problem is something else. When you look at history, it is quite clear that the state at some point has busted some trusts. But taking a closer look, I mean, I think a very famous example might be Standard Oil. This was so-called busted by the state, but when we take a closer look, we must admit that the state failed and probably intended to fail. And there was never an end to the Standard Oil Trust, and the Seven Sisters cooperated like never before. And so whether the state is a solution is, you know, to be honest, you know, Robert, I've been thinking about this really very long and very hard. And what it all comes down to eventually is that it is very, very difficult to envisage something on an institutionalized level that will solve these problems. What we really need is just sufficient able-bodied and able-minded men who can actually see through all this bullshit and realize that there is clearly a plutocracy that is using its power, abusing its power to basically enslave everybody, and it's working both through its international cartels and its leverage over the state. And I don't really believe that the solution to the money power or the Illuminati or whatever you want to call them is a strong state, because history clearly shows that the state always was controlled by complete freaks, and whether you have a strong international operating state or a massive international cartel that wields all this power, it basically is all power, and power completely corrupts. It's as simple as that. So it must be some kind of an individual awakening. Eventually it all comes down to making peace with God, with ourselves, and showing our real potential, or at least to have sufficient people doing so.
So the thing with the libertarians is they're kind of obsessed with the slogan choice.
Mm.
That's what you write about. But the thing is, under the free market, you disagree that the free market necessarily brings about what they describe as choice.
Obviously. I mean, market players do not want to offer you choice. They want to offer you, you know, maybe a choice between two of their products, but they don't want to give you a real choice. And what is the value of a choice when it's between a rock and a hard place, you know? And we've seen this recent bogus election. People were saying, oh, we're taking the lesser evil. And that is, you know, always the choice that that the opposition wants to provide us with. Evil and lesser evil. And so the idea of choice and you know, they will always say, oh, as long as it's voluntary. But if you're completely starving, you will voluntarily sell your children. That's the example that I give in the article. And what kind of a choice is that? I mean, it's no choice. It's complete bogus. It's a mirage. It's childishly stupid, actually, to focus on this this whole concept of choice. I mean, the quality of the choice is at least as important as the idea of choice itself.
So you posted this video by it's an interview by John Madai, and I've interviewed him a while back. He had a book out called "Towards a Truly Free Market."
Recently, I read a bit of his work, and I was very impressed with his with his. It was what he was proposing and analyzing. a great interview. He's also completely destroying the idea of capitalism being associated with free markets. I also have an article on what is capitalism, in which I suppose that I propose that people say capitalism is the idea of free markets, but that it is quite obvious when you take a closer look that capitalism is the opposite of free markets, because capitalism wants monopolies and absolutely does not want free markets. And the idea that capitalism is associated with free markets is a complete hoax. And if you look at the current situation worldwide, it's absolutely clear that there are no free markets, but just massive cartels that control, you know, that control and divide markets between them. And John Madaya made a very clear case for this in this video that I've been offering as an afterthought on this article.
The thing with distributism is it's sort of a philosophy of having a society of a lot of like small businesses and small farms, and that's sort of that's sort of the goal. But the question is, how do you get there from where we are now?
Well, you know, that's indeed what I propose also, or not propose, but what I see as a healthy society, because what it's all about is that you need to have many small masters and not a few big ones, and you want every free man to be the master of his own domain, and he will be able to take care and give guidance to women, children, the elderly, and the younger men. And you need to have you need the power to be distributed, and that's of course where the phrase distributism comes from. You need to distribute power throughout society and not centralize it, as it's clearly being done now in monopolies, cartels, world governments, national governments. And I agree with that. And what I did in my article, What is Capitalism?, which can be found in, I think, Interest Free Economics also, is that I made very clear that the essence of capitalism is in first place the domination of capital over labor. That's why we call it capitalism. It's a system where capital dominates labor. And the second issue is that they do this by control of the money supply. And this is, of course, one of the basic premises of basically the entire conspiracy industry, but also very much so real currencies. That the powers that be, what I call the money power, rule through control of the money supply, and they use this control to destroy us with usury in the first place. That's the biggest item. Secondly, the boom bust cycle, and third, the ability to control who gets finance and who not, because that's a very important issue also. But what you need is to end usury, because usury is the great concentrator of power. Because as we discussed in the previous interview that we did, usury leads to a wealth transfer from the poorest 80% to the richest 10%. And within the richest 10% bracket, the poorest 8% of the richest 10% pay more than they receive to the richest 1%. And when you look at usury, what transpires is that ultimately all the money ends up at the absolute top of the food chain. And that's the great concentrator of wealth and the associated power. So ending usury means simply that the productive capacity of a man and women too, of course, remains with the producer himself. So the laborer himself, the businessman himself, the craftsman, the whatever. And this is what we want. I mean, people create stuff, and the added value of what they do should remain with themselves, instead of being destroyed by usurious loans by the capitalist class. That's what, and in this way, we don't even really need to redistribute. Although the other issue, of course, is that the elites at this point control and outright own massive and incredible fortunes. You know, you know the story about the Rothschilds being worth it anywhere between 50 and 500 trillion dollars.
Yeah, but, and I mean, I think, personally, I think that wealth is, I think it's ill-gotten, I think it should all be confiscated.
Yeah, you know, and that's maybe a bit of a sore point with the libertarian defenders of the rights of the rich and the property
class.
Yeah,
I mean, the funny thing is a lot of these people, like Alex Jones, you know, like the people like Alex Jones, they're always going on these long rants about how evil the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds are. But then if you actually ask those people, like, do you think their fortune should be confiscated? I mean, I don't know what Alex Jones would say, but then a lot of those libertarians say, well, that's a violation of the free market.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point, and it's complete nonsense. But you know, the charming thing is that if we do what you propose, you know, and just end the redistribution, I think that what you would see is that the great monopolies of these days, banking, oil, telecommunications, food, arms, these are just completely artificial monopolies. I think in this day and age, that we actually use oil as the main energy source is just, well, just a testament to the stupidity of the masses. It's almost as incredible as the idea that we're being enslaved by money that is printed out of nothing. But the same goes with food supplies. You know, I mean, clearly the so-called GMO foods are just utterly horrendous, and all the corporations that are now successful in fooling us into eating this stuff will eventually dissolve if the distribution from poor to rich ends. And so all these monopolies that give the Rothschilds their asset worth and their asset positions. They are basically based on bogus wealth. There is no real wealth there because all these monopolies are based on a lie. So if the lie goes away, the monopoly goes away and the wealth goes away. So we don't even have to take it away from them. We just have to destroy the lie.
And you've written about this Austrian economist, Tom Woods. And you say you call it the Catholic arm of libertarianism.
Yeah,
because I know distributism and a social credit are very much they have strong Catholic influences. So Tom Woods is he has this sort of a Catholic libertarian movement going on.
Yeah, well, my friend Meme Hunter, he did a very important article in the summer and in the spring about the Catholic arm of libertarianism, and he clearly showed, and a man like Lou Rockwell actually admitted this himself, that libertarianism actually goes back to the Jesuits of Spain in the 17th century, and it's really a very long-term kind of mindset, kind of ideology that they have been promoting throughout the ages. The same Jesuits actually did some proto-communism work in several colonies in Latin America in the same era. And the extreme free market ideology that they have been promoting, and which has morphed into libertarianism these days, has very, very solid footing in Jesuit thinking. And also, the Jesuits have played a very, very remarkable and profound role in legitimizing usury throughout modern history. I mean, up to the Renaissance, obviously, usury was completely illegal and immoral, and you know, a complete crime in Catholic Europe. But as of the Renaissance and with the rise of the international financier classes associated with the Renaissance and later the so-called Enlightenment. The financier class has actually managed to erode this resistance against usury, and the Jesuits played a very important role in providing the intellectual legitimacy for this. And this has been going on for centuries, and it's continuing up till today. And you have this Jesuit hotbed of agitation in the U.S., and it's led by this James Sadowski. And he's the guy that is behind Tom Woods and also behind Murray Rothbard. And I think it's very likely, and that Meme Hunter, obviously these things are very difficult to prove 100%, but Meme Hunter actually provided a very straightforward link going on from the Spanish Jesuits all the way up today.
Do you think the modern-day libertarians and people like Ron Paul on those issues, do you think they have are you saying that they have nefarious agendas, or do you think they're just sort of misguided on those issues?
No. A man like Ron Paul, you know, when you take a really close look at the so-called libertarian movement, you see just a few names, and you see obviously these semi-gods of them, Mises and von Hayek, somewhat later Rothbard, Lou Rockwell. Ron Paul has been with them for 40 years already. Lou Rockwell is one of the young guys. Paul is a bit older already. Thomas Woods is now being groomed as the heir apparent of the Rockwell operation with the Mises Institute. And this is this very small group of people that are also closely linked via the Agora publishing empire, which is directly linked to the Rothschild empire via Lord Rees-Mogg, who was an ex-board member of the BBC. So, you know, it's a very clear, direct link to the Rothschilds today, between the people that I just mentioned, the BBC, Rees-Mogg. And these people have been at this together with their mother, Rothbard, and, of course, also Gary North, who has been with these people forever. He's been with them for 50 years already, and he's, of course, in twilight now of his career, but he's been doing what he's doing today, he's been doing that for 50 years. And these people know exactly what they are doing, what is going on, who is behind this. You know, they have been consistently providing the intellectual framework for the great hoax that is libertarianism.
And you have an article about the Austrian versus Keynesian dialect, and it's about central banks and do central banks really control the money supply? First of all, what is your definition of Keynesian economics?
Basically, it's based on the same half-baked capitalism with so-called free markets and central banking. It's associated with fiat currencies, usurious fiat currencies, because, you know, that's one of the issues that is obscured by libertarianism. Fiat money is not fiat money, you know. You have dozens of different systems that are basically based on fiat money, but the current system that we have, fractional reserve banking, paper-based fractional reserve banking, usurious, with the basic catch that in time that the Keynes described the business cycle as a result of collapsing demand in the economy, and he provided the idea of having governments go into debt to print to create more demand and to what they call reflate the economy, and this is the basic idea of Keynesianism.
And you write about the sort of the end the Fed mantra, which is prevalent among libertarians and Austrian economics, and they say that they say that the central bank controls the money supply, but doesn't. I mean, you talked about Ed Griffin's
one of the basic one of the basic premises of currencies is that the banking system is one. And to make the issue a central banking issue is a typical, absolutely typical libertarian hoax. I don't even think that the old maestros of libertarianism of Austrian economics actually would you know fully support this notion. But nowadays, outlets like the Daily Bell, but also a man like Thomas Woods and Gary North and, you know, the basic, and of course the end of Fed movement, which is a typical example, is all about central banking, and the Wall Street and the banks are so-called free market enterprises, and the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, these are statist operations, and they are messing up the free market, heroes of banking. But it's all complete nonsense. Everybody knows nowadays that the Federal Reserve Bank is owned by the commercial banks. So it's quite clear that there is absolutely that the Federal Reserve does nothing but serve the interests of these private banks. Only a few months ago, it was reported with the Fed audit that the Federal Reserve actually handed out 0% credit to the tune of $16 trillion. $16 trillion, which is more than American GDP, to its main shareholders, being Citibank, American Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and all the other criminal enterprises out there. And libertarianism basically is saying, well, if you don't have central banks, banking will get back in control. They provide absolutely zero evidence for this. and it's complete nonsense.
Yeah, that's the thing. Well, libertarians, and I was going to mention the book by Ed Griffin, The Creature from Jekyll Island. I mean, Ed Griffin, I've read the book. The book itself is correct that the Federal Reserve was set up by private bankers. It's just, so they're not necessarily, I mean, they're correct when they say that the Federal Reserve is run by private bankers, but it's just that they don't provide a real alternative.
Well, if they're saying, it's the same thing with saying, okay, the state is the problem because they're helping the commercial entities with monopolizing markets. But so why not say, okay, if the state helps these companies, why don't we blame the companies themselves? And it's the same with the Federal Reserve. If the Federal Reserve is owned by the commercial banks, why do we say the commercial banks are not the problem, but the Federal Reserve is the problem, whereas the Federal Reserve is controlled and outright owned by these same banks? I mean, it's the logical fallacy of this is so blatant and obvious. It's really insane that it has gained so much traction in the alternative media.
And you have this chart up. It's about the role of central banking dogma in the Austrian versus Keynesian dialect. So that you're saying the Keynesians, they say they want a big government. Well, the Austrians want small or none government. Keynesians want a soft currency. Austrians want a hard currency. The Keynesians want a central bank, and the Austrians want basically they want to get rid of the central bank. And the Keynesians say that excessive saving causes recessions, and the Austrians say government intervention causes the recessions. And you're saying that they're both wrong.
Well, it's not even that they're wrong, but they're picking out one thing and they're focusing on that, and they're proposing an opposite, and they own both poles of the conflict, and this is the dialectic. And they have these opposites slugged out, and since they own both, the result of this conflict will be a synthesis that is also to their that suits also their purposes. And you know, I did another article on the same dialectic, which is called the inflation versus deflation dialectic. It's basically about the soft versus hard currency. The issue is that they say the Keynes people say we need a flexible money supply, credit based. The Austrians say no, this is always leads to inflation and to government messing up the volume of this money supply, and they have these people slug it up between them. Whereas the real issue with the money supply, basically, namely that all the credit is being lent out at interest, whereas the money supply itself is a monopolistically controlled, whether it's paper or whether it's gold, and that the interest ends up with the same people, because the people that own the printing press also own the gold, which Austrians vehemently deny, but which is completely insane that they even try to deny that. But the fact is that the real issue is usury, and this is what they both ignore. And this is the basic way of operating. You know, you create a false dialectic, a false confrontation, in which both ignore the real issue. In this case, usury.
So you talk about alternatives, and it's sort of the dichotomy you were talking about was the central bank versus the free market free market banking system, and that's a fraudulent dichotomy. But what needs to happen is to have you've talked about the public banking movement, which is Ellen Brown runs, and what they advocate is basically having public banking that's debt free and free of, and it gets rid of usury. But it's done on a local level, and you write about your most recent article is a local interest-free currency.
Yeah, well, you know, public banking. I'm sympathetic towards Anne Brown's work, but there are a few issues with public banking. In the first place, it's not interest-free. And that's a really very profound problem, because Alan Brown simply states, well, the usury now ends up with a private banking cartel. If we do it publicly, it will end up with the state, and this will be a handsome income for the state. But fractional reserve banking is extremely cheap, and that's not fractional reserve banking. Actually, is a very inefficient way of creating money. Mutual credit is far far superior, but the credit basically costs nothing to produce. I mean, an interest-free mortgage is completely feasible simply because you have the house as collateral, so there's absolutely zero risk for the bank. And the credit is created the minute the mortgage is taken out. Even if you have a low-interest mortgage, 3-4%, for a 100,000 mortgage, you will pay 100,000 interest over 30 years, which is completely insane considering the cost of creating this loan. And So public banking is not interest-free, and it is really very empowering for the state. And this is the problem that I have with it. If public banking really should be interest-free, and then it would be a very viable option. But at the moment, it is not.
Well, you give an example of one alternative. What's called? It's this bank in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And is this what? Well, there was a bank. It was a Swedish bank that was active from started in 1965. Is this still active today?
Yeah, it's still active today, and it's gaining traction all over the world, slowly but surely. It's called the Yacht Bank, and but the difference between a Yacht Bank and a public banking is. Public banking is just like nowadays banking. It's based on fractional reserve banking. So all the credit that is being loaned out by these banks is created the minute it is, you know, the people go into debt, and that is when the money is created. And the Yacht Bank is full reserve banking. So what is being lent out is deposits of savers. And the Yacht Bank actually has created a methodology to be able to do this interest-free. And it basically works like this. You start saving. And by saving, you gain the right to have interest-free credit in the future yourself. But while you are saving, you are providing the deposits that are being lent out by the bank. And because you will be able to borrow interest-free in the future, you have a very clear incentive to save with this bank, even though it does not pay you interest. But because you are gaining interest-free credit rights in the future, you have what you lose by not getting paid interest is more than compensated by the interest-free loans of the future. And this is so. This in this way, absolutely no money creation is involved. It's a not fractional reserve banking. It's full reserve banking, and it's interest free. And so it actually could be quite complementary to public banking because also mutual credit based systems. Because at this point, what you have in the economy is okay. The banks create all the money that they lend out, but every dollar in circulation has been lent out maybe 3 or 4 times because pension funds. Other major financial players, they have capital and they lend this out at interest. But it's what they lend out is already existing dollars. They do not create money. But so everybody that is every dollar that is in circulation at this point is being lent out maybe 3 or 4 times and all at interest. So with the Yacht Bank banking, we could do this interest free.
So these are the four basic principles that the Yacht Bank operates under, and I'd like you to comment on sort of on each of these things. So the first part is that charging interest is applicable to a stable economy.
Yeah, well, the issue with that is that if you have usurious debts, if you take out a loan for $100,000 at 10%, at the end of the year, you have to repay $110,000 principal plus interest, and you only borrowed $100,000. And if you have this this fractional reserve banking environment, the money was created, the principal was created, but the interest was not. And this is, of course, one of the basic tenets of interest-free economics, that this is intrinsically unstable because the debt plus interest can never be repaid because there's simply not enough money in circulation.
And the interest, it causes unemployment, inflation, and environmental destruction. I think inflation is that part is more obvious, but you can comment on that, but also the unemployment and environmental destruction, that part we haven't got into as much.
Yeah, okay. Well, the unemployment bit is that because of the part of the principal is required to pay back the interest, and the interest thus cannot be used for investment and for hiring people. So there's always intrinsic lack of capital in the economy. There's never enough capital available because of the interest to fully exploit the economy or the economic potential of the nation or the community or whatever. So because of the interest going up, you know, to the absolute top of the food chain, where it's just sitting there and enlarging the wealth of the not so happy few, and this money is simply not available for the economy, and that's why the why there is an unemployment is basically unavoidable in a usurious economy. And the environmental destruction, it's also a very important point, which is, I think, basically a little not sufficiently discussed in interest-free economics. Maybe I should do an article on that myself also. But the basic issue is that usurious loans are basically prohibitive when it comes to long-term investment. If you look at non-usurious medieval economy, these people started building cathedrals at some point, and they took a century to build these things because before they even became operational. And that is completely impossible now. Long-term investment is impossible these days because of these exponentially growing costs for capital. And this is now comes the problem with the environment. This is the reason why people try to postpone future costs as long as possible, because they need to repay the principal as quickly as possible, and they will basically prefer to have the environment suffer if they can quickly pay off the initial investment. And that's why you have this unsustainable way of investing that you see nowadays, and ever shorter times that are required by investors before the investment is paid back, etc. And this is why we make the environment and natural resources.
And the thing with the environment is that the economic system it depends on growth. It's a growth-based economic system. That's why it's not sustainable.
That's the big instability of the system, but obviously to make this growth possible, we are taking natural resources that we might use in maybe 100 years, you know, instead of now immediately. But also simply the fact that we need nowadays need women to flood the labor markets, you know. All the women are now working. Has our standard of living risen since the 50s or 60s when only men were working? If you have a real close look at what a common worker brought home 30, 40 years ago, you will see that it actually has declined massively in real terms. And so you know, we need to involve everything that we've got into the economic process to even maintain current standards of living, just to pay off all this ever mounting cost of capital that we're faced with.
And that's the other thing is interest. It yields high profits in the short term.
Yeah, because the focus is on high profits in the short term, because the principal has to be repaid, because the every year that it takes longer to repay the original investment, the cost for capital only increases. So profits need to be very stiff in the short term to be able to for the investment to be viable.
And the loans, so under the Yacht Bank, the loans they're backed by either collateral or this is under the current system that the loans are backed by either collateral or guarantors.
Well, no, in the Yacht Banking, it's how it's done. But basically, it's always the same with money creation, even in the current system, but also in interest-free economics. There's always collateral that is backing the credit-based currency.
Have there been any? Do you know of any political movements in Europe that are adopting a lot of the ideas that you advocate?
At this point, not really. No, what you have is the regional currency movement, which is really gaining traction throughout the world, because it's big in the United States also, but it's also big in Germany and Britain. As you know, I'm running a regional currency in the Netherlands myself, and so this is actually very, you know, practical way of implementing interest-free economics, but there's not really a political movement associated with anti-usury activism or, you know, interest-free economics. It's nowhere in the world, and, you know, we discussed this, I think, officially in the last chat that we did. One of the major problems, of course, is that anti-usury activism is closely associated to anti-Semitism. So resisting usury is profoundly politically incorrect.
Or it's associated, or the other thing is they associate it with fascism.
Yeah, obviously, yeah, because one of the key issues with Nazism was the kernel of National Socialism is breaking the thraldom of interest.
Yeah, I mean, there's up on the website, Countercurrents, that I do the show on, there's actually an article by, I think it's by, do you know Kerry Bolden from New Zealand?
I think I know the article that you're referring to.
Yeah, it's about Gottfried Feder.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Gottfried Feder was a great light of anti-usury activism and one of the major leaders in Nazism until he got sidelined in the second half of the 30s.
So, and I know with there's an organization in Italy, Casa Pound, which I think they support social credit, but their inspiration is and their namesake is from Ezra Pound.
An Italian nationalist far-right movement with fascist leanings,
That's how they describe people. But in the United States, I mean, if you look at the political structure, is you basically have the libertarian movement, and then you have the sort of Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, you know, both these movements, they're just playing the left-right divide. The Occupy movement is closely associated with the liberal part of the establishment run by George Soros, and the libertarians are run by people like the Koch brothers and the Agora publishing empire and associated plutocrats that are behind that, but they're all the same people, and it's basically just left-right divide. And the real classic opposition in the United States, and basically the classic opposition against international banking worldwide, which was led by this American movement, was the populists of the late 19th century. And I really sympathize with American populism and anti-money power positions, you know, based on interest-free government-produced units.
And that's what happened in this country. There was a strong populist movement in the early 20th century, but then it really died out after World War II. And then starting in the 60s, we kind of got the conservative versus liberal dichotomy that we have today.
Exactly. And the organized opposition was the people of the John Birch Society, founded by Fred Koch, and you know, closely associated with men like... what's his name? You just mentioned him, Griffin. And later the libertarians, which was supposedly constitutionalist and anti-New World Order, anti-communist. But the telltale was, of course, their the monetary proposal, which was gold-based. And gold is just a complete banker meme, and the banking fraternity loves gold, and the libertarians are just usurping the populist position on money, which is based on interest-free, debt-free greenbacks.
And the other thing about libertarians is libertarians, a lot of them, I mean, they're for open borders and free trade, which is a big part of it. I mean, they're globalist in that sense, even though they say that they're anti-globalist.
Yeah,
I mean, Ron Paul's son, who's in the U.S. Senate, Rand Paul, he just came out in favor of amnesty.
Now, this is, the free market is everything, and the free market is, you know, very obviously very pleasant for the ultra-powerful. because they have the means and the wherewithal to dominate these markets. And obviously, they are very much in favor of illegal immigration because it provides them with low-cost labor, and it disunites the national opposition that they're facing with their national cosmopolitanism. And the idea that nations and but not even nations. I mean, even a nation is already an aberration because there is no United States nation. You know, you have Californians and you have Texans and you have Canadians. Okay, that's not U.S., but you know what I'm saying. And you have the East Coast. It's the same in Europe. You know, I mean, I live here in Holland, but Holland is absolutely completely. Very small country, as you know, but even here we have very distinctive regions where people have their own dialects and their own customs that go back ages and ages. And the nation state already, which became prevalent in the 19th century, was already a great unifier and a great destructor of ancient local tradition. And so even the nation state is already very aggressive and very overbearing and very a great monopolizer of power, a centralizer of power. And, you know, we need to have more respect for local and regional customs. And
that's what has happened in this country. Is the local cultures have been totally wiped out by mass consumerism.
Exactly, and that's so. Even the nation state is already an example for what it will be like in a completely globalized environment, where even nation states succumb to even larger scale identities with big quotes, because there is no real identity left at that time at that point.
Before I wrap the show up, is there anything else you'd like to add about these topics?
No, I think I basically we talked about what I would like to say. So that's about it.
And that was Anthony Mickles of realcurrencies.wordpress.com. Thanks again for being on the show.
And thank you for having me.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.